This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Welcome to Talk of Asian Marketing. In today's show, are you chicken? I guess you can guess from the title. We're going to be talking about chickens, or that could be us, I suppose. Or actually, it could be you. If you ever have a chance to come over to Hong Kong, Singapore, China, you may actually chicken out on buying your chickens. Stephen?
Yes?
Have you been eating any chickens? And let me introduce you before I go any further, because I've got your school's name down pat, National Kaohsiung First University of Science and Technology.
Yes. Very smooth. Huh?
Yeah, I really got that one down. Stephen, you've been eating a lot of chicken lately. You're not a vegetarian, are you?
No, I'm not vegetarian, but I eat vegetable very much.
Yeah, I think it's pretty common in the diet of Chinese in general. We do eat a lot of vegetables. One thing I love about living in Taiwan, lots of fresh vegetables. James, who's from Tsinghua University of Education, you are not a vegetarian, I do not believe.
No, I love good piece of dead animal, as I fondly call it. And like Stephen, though, I'm a big fan of the fresh vegetables you can get here, which I guess makes me a bit of a fan of Chinese food, since it's often a good combination of meat and veg.
Yeah, so we do get a lot of vegetables, a lot of fruit in Taiwan, and in the Chinese diet, I think, in general, especially in places like Singapore, Hong Kong, it's very easy to find that. It's a big contrast, I think, when you go to the U.S., and from what I know of food in Britain, too, where you get large pieces of meat and very little on the vegetable side. Can you confirm this, James?
From your observation, I don't think we're quite as bad as the Americans in this regard. We have this famous obsession for a meat and two veg, which is a bit of a sort of idiom in the Brit vocabulary. And so vegetables certainly pay... Yeah, fair part of the diet, although some of them, when they're boiled and unappealing, make you wonder why you are eating them.
So you right there, you're stepping on kind of the idea that is the core of the show today, which is the concept of freshness inside the Chinese culinary arts. Lot of emphasis on freshness. So today's show, we're going to look at that and how that plays a role in the channel distribution and how that works out in the case of poultry. It's just an example, but I think it's a really good example that everybody knows about, you can see. It's very common for visitors to come to Taiwan, even for a short time, even in a city like Taipei, and see, to their great surprise, people riding around on motorcycles in the morning with big buckets and boxes on the back full of chicken bodies running off to the market. Of course, that is if you get up in time. You have to get up around 4 or 5, maybe at the latest 6 in the morning, because that's when those markets are open. And they're fresh markets. Stephen, I like to call them wet markets, but I think in Chinese that's not actually what we call them. Could you tell us how this is labeled in Chinese?
菜市场.
菜市场. Or yes. Even the, a lot of people like to call it 传统市场. How do you feel
about it? Yeah, 传统市场 is a formal name by the government.
Oh, okay. You know, I really don't like that name because 传统市场, traditional market, to me, it kind of has a value label to it, as if there's a old one and a new one, and somehow the new one's better. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Do most local Chinese, when they say 传统市场, do they? I guess they don't have any value feeling negative, do they?
Yes. No.
You know what? It's hard to explain. Never mind.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm obsessed with the whole concept of, assumption of modernity. And that's what really bugs me so much, as you guys know. It just bugs me to no end. And the idea of labeling it the traditional market to Western ears. James, if I told you the traditional market, don't you kind of get a picture that, well, why am I going there? Why don't I go to the new market?
Yes, it can make it sound a little bit sort of old worldly kind of thing, and particularly since the government has been trying to sort of upgrade them, and there's that background obsession with improving them that just hasn't worked out, and the sort of improvements that the government have made in those markets seem in many cases not to have yielded particularly positive results. So I kind of go with your feeling that someone's got an idea of something that's modern and bright and shiny and air-conditioned and far, far away from what the wet market looks like.
Yeah, exactly. And that's going to be another show. We're going to do a special show, a series of shows on the wet market and the night market, which are big things in Taiwan. But today we're going to talk about these two different channels. One channel we've just touched on, this fresh market, this or traditional market, or as I like to call it, the wet market. And the other market, which most of our listeners would be very familiar with, which is the super slash hypermarket market channel. And so we're going to look at how you purchase poultry through these two different channels and how the cultural implications may influence the whole thing you need to pay attention to when you're marketing in these different channels. So, Stephen, could you give us a little background on hypermarkets or supermarkets in Taiwan, since it seems that for most Westerners, if they bought chicken, that would be their only option?
Yes. Okay, the first local warehouse hypermarket was launched in 1979, but the first foreign hypermarket by the SHV went to Taiwan in 1989.
That's
the first one. Yeah.
So that would be the first.
And at the same time, the California is was also in Taiwan.
Yeah, we have other supermarkets like a Welcome Supermarket, which is originally from Hong Kong, I believe.
Yes.
And what about the Xinrong? Xinrong, Caozi Sichang, is that a local?
It's a local one.
Mm-hmm. That's a local one. So yeah. We've had these supermarkets since the 70s, has it? Do you remember when you were a little boy going to any of these supermarkets, Stephen?
Yes. Yeah, 70 and the late 70s.
Late 70s. Yeah, I think it's hard for people sometimes when they visit Taiwan to realize how short the time on this kind of changes in infrastructure has been. Some anthropological studies I've seen have photographs and pictures from, you know, not too long ago, the 60s, and Taiwan was a really different place. I don't know if you've seen any photos like that, James, but Taipei
well,
now.
I can just imagine, because when you look around at the sort of volume of concrete buildings here, you can sort of really get a feel for the speed of growth. And at the end of the day, it's really only, what, 50, 60 years that Taiwan's been that kind of industrial powerhouse. So I really can imagine, and my wife tells me often about places where we're walking around, how when she was young, or just even 10 years back, how there was absolutely nothing there. So I think it's very easy to forget how quickly Taiwan has actually economically developed. And really, it's only in the last, 10, 15 years with incomes really rising up quickly that people have been able to start to think about things that many other people sort of take for granted, like fresh orange juice and milk and these sort of products. And way back in the sort of 60s and 70s, where we've just been talking about, many of those things were just sort of not on people's agenda, either because incomes weren't sort of up at that level, and they just weren't thinking about that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. In fact, I would say that probably in the late 60s, early 70s, the only exposure people would have to these kinds of products would be through the military supply depots that were common in Taiwan, actually, because there was U.S. military bases. In fact, there was a big base not far from my home where I live in Taichung. And so supposedly, you know, you could get contacts there and you could get people, soldiers, to buy things for you, bring them out, or you could, if you had a special relationship, go in there and buy things. But since then, of course, we've had the development of supermarket channels. And those supermarket channels have helped to bring some of those things forward. And I think I like to look at this as kind of similar to the Japanese department store, in that in Taiwan, supermarkets have had a dual role. On the one hand, they're a channel that, you know, increases its efficiency, gets the products out there, distributes them, breaks them up. But on the other hand, it's also been a kind of educator. Stephen, you know, when I came here first in 1985, I couldn't find any place to get fresh milk. I'm sure now we go around, we see fresh milk everywhere. This must have been a kind of education process through the supermarket. What do you think of that?
Yeah, yeah, you are right. Maybe it's the phenomenon or the channel. I mean, at the time you came to Taiwan, you cannot buy the fresh mail in the store. The fresh mail the fresh mail milk in the bottle was delivered by the local farm.
Yeah, right. I know. That's an interesting point. In fact, that's one of those little tips. You know, I love having a lot of local friends and getting involved in these things, because Stephen brings up something that maybe, James, you haven't seen. You can get these bottle milks delivered to your home, and it's still today, it's true. And they come and they have like totally, you know, 50 different flavored milks that come to your home. They bring it up.
Jeez,
in a case. It's great. It's a really great convenience. It's really, it's not one bottle. It's a bunch of little bottles you can have delivered to your home.
Mm-hmm. And that's even in the city, or is that sort of...
Yeah, definitely in the city.
Oh, wow. And that's the farmer that does that direct, is it? Or it's a middleman?
I think in this case it's a middleman because I'm in the city, but you actually see in Taiwan, it's very common. If you look at people's mailboxes, sometimes they'll have a little plastic case, and that case will have two little holes in it, and that's actually put goat milk in because so many people have lactose intolerance, but they can drink goat milk.
Yeah,
wow, that's just like the old British tradition of the milkman.
So, I mean, it's really great. There's a lot of these things a lot of people visiting Taiwan don't see. And a lot of marketers, I think, they're blind to it. And they just assume that the only channels existing are these ones we're familiar with. And I think there's something about that pattern recognition, right? I've got a pattern in my head. I think you were talking about this last week, James. I have a pattern in my head. I'm a manager from the West. I come in here, I see the pattern I saw back home. Everything looks okay, fine, I leave. When actually there's a whole nother pattern underlying there that you're not seeing because you're not up 5 a.m. to see the chickens being delivered. You're not looking at the milk being delivered to people's homes like Stephen just said.
Exactly, yes, I think that's, or it has enough of the features that you can explain it by what you've seen at home, and it's only after a short time and with exposure to some of those real local customs that suddenly you realize there's a whole host of different meanings, different patterns that actually underlie what's happening, and your sort of original Western or other country way of thinking about what you're seeing doesn't actually really make that much sense.
Or you're missing a lot of opportunity that the market has and you've just totally overlooked it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Or what we often find, you know, you and I and Stephen in our research is that if you just tweaked your product or tweaked your service a little bit aware of these other things, you'd be hitting a home run on making that communication clear. But instead, you're comfortable because the communication is clear to you.
Yes.
Well, James.
Yes, it's like just I always like the analogy of like turning a dial. You know, it's moving the dial around from maybe just pointing at 1 o'clock to moving just around to pointing at 3 o'clock, and suddenly the safe door opens and you're looking at the gold.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, James. I think you've mentioned before your wife visits the traditional / wet market often. So we've just talked about supermarkets, certainly supermarkets, hypermarkets since the late 70s, early 80s, and hypermarkets late 80s have really penetrated everywhere. We have them at, you know, every place. It's easy to get to, even on your bicycle. But we still have a lot of people shopping and at the traditional market, and your wife is one of them, James?
Absolutely. It's kind of interesting as you were talking there. I was thinking about our previous show, the breakfast show, in fact. And to be honest, a lot of the time, my wife and I will just pop downstairs when we need to eat and go to one of the little eateries downstairs that have got pretty cheap and easy food, sort of similar to the pattern that we talked about for breakfast. But on occasion, my wife really likes to cook, and I'm really happy about that. And rather than diving off to the hypermarket like I guess she would have done in the UK, she sort of gets on her scooter and a little while later comes back with all these nice vegetables and meat and so on, and she's gone direct to the wet market. And Yeah, it did surprise me for a little while because I thought, well, it's, you know, it's so nice and easy, and you go to the hypermarket, and it's wrapped up, and it's cool, and so on. But when she was younger, it was something that she used to see and do with her grandmother. And grandmother was very traditional. She was from the south, and the wet market was where she used to go and buy everything. And to be honest, as well, she lived in a slightly more rural community, so she could get other products direct from the farmer as well. So it was something I think that she'd sort of seen and been brought up with and got familiar with. And even now, the immediate instinct when she's going to cook and she wants those vegetables, the meat and so on, is just to head straight over to the wet market. And there's a really big one. I've been with her a few times and it's a real great experience, and she's got a few contacts in there that give her maybe the odd bone and other bits that they just can't sell because they know she's got a dog and this is great for the dog and so on. It's real fun actually to go.
Bonus
even
for the
I doggy. Enjoy.
That's great. How far is that market from your house, James?
That one is, I'd say about 10 minutes because I don't know why my wife chooses that one. There's probably one a little bit closer, but it's a really big one and it's got everything, right from really nice fresh fruit through to meat, through to veg, through to pre-cooked food. And it's all together in a big, big square place. And they run, the hours are pretty, pretty comfortable as well. So this is, my wife's not a very early morning kind of person. So this market runs right through the day. So it's real convenient for both of us.
Oh, really? It's open throughout the day? That's unusual for most morning markets shut down around noontime.
Yes, this one seems to run on a little bit longer, I think, because they do have such a big variety in there, right from the fruits, right through. So, and they're in such a great location. It's right on the intersection of two really busy roads. So they get people from a really big catchment area.
Interesting. I think something that our listeners might be hard to get their head around is, of course, in the U.S. and I think in the U.K. too, you can find stands and stalls on the roadside near some farms. And you can buy some fresh produce, of course. But what we're talking here is even in the inner city, you have these wet markets set up. Stephen, you were living in Taipei before. Did you ever have a chance to visit some of the wet markets in Taipei? Because there are some very strategically located right downtown.
Yeah. Yes. Actually, in the bigger city, there are a lot of the wet markets.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just like you would never see it if you weren't there when in the morning when everybody's packing in, because in the afternoon they're all cleaned up.
Yeah, but there are three kinds of wet markets. One is the morning wet market, as you said, but there are a lot of evening market or afternoon markets.
So we have kind of three basic categories. Your early morning market, that's like very early. I think I've seen a lot of these markets start opening up around 5 in the morning, sometimes earlier if it's near a holiday. Your afternoon markets, which tend to be open before dinner, right? So that's 2 at the earliest, 3 in the afternoon, and they stay open until probably 5 or 6. They're still going. And then a little bit later market, right, Stephen? I've seen a lot of those too, later markets.
Later market, night market, okay.
Like a night market, okay. Yeah, right. And we're going to talk about night markets in another show, but I don't think you're going to find many fresh chickens at the night market, but you do find lots of fresh chickens in the morning market and in the afternoon wet market. And these two markets can be at the same location, although I find lots of them are not. So a morning market will be open in the morning, and then the afternoon it's not. And then an afternoon market will be open in the afternoon, but in the morning it's not, although some do open at multiple times.
Right.
So this is really neat. I mean, just for example, near my house, I can take my bicycle and literally 5 minutes away there's a morning market, 10 minutes away there's an afternoon market. I can jump on there and get over to the afternoon market and get everything I need for dinner right there. And you know, very reasonable price too, which is another point. I think on price, these markets are very competitive. Stephen, do you have any idea about this price competition?
Yeah, because many stands in the same wet market. right?
Yeah, so yeah, they, right. A lot of competition going on inside the market.
Yes. They use wires.
Right. Nobody can raise their price too high, yeah. But I mean, compared to the hypermarket, I have found the prices very competitive. And just a day before yesterday, I'd stop at Costco, and my wife said, get some green onions. We need to cook up some soup. And of course, at Costco, everything being the way it is, they had a huge bag of huge green onions. And and they're from California, I think, but they were more expensive than the locally obtained green onions. And my wife didn't like the idea of having these humongous green onions. She thought, I don't know if it's true or not, we didn't test it, but she thought it would be less flavorful.
Ah, sure. So you had to buy, what, like 10 kilos or something of these green onions?
They were just really, they're like bigger than a couple of your fingers together. And you know, the local green onions can get really tiny.
Well, I hope you tested them for anabolic steroids.
Yeah, there you go. That's what it is. They're some kind of genetic freaks or something from Costco. But anyway, so that leads us to this idea of Chinese food. You know, everybody knows about Chinese food because there's Chinese restaurants every place in the world, I think. That's for sure. But in Chinese culture, in places like Singapore, Hong Kong, China, Taiwan, you know, these dinners that people sit down to, not so much lunch, but really family dinners, the kind of food you eat is really, really important. And in fact, the food is linked to things such as even medicine. James, do you have any idea about food? And does your wife ever get into these different kinds of food?
A little bit. But her sister has got like a slow cooker, and sometimes she boils up a soup, and in, you know, it's a chicken sort of broth, but with lots of herbs and plants and sort of various extracts. And it's a sort of medicine soup. And usually she's not feeling right, or she's got some sort of ailment kind of thing, and she cooks up this broth. And to be honest, I have to say the flavor's a bit unusual, but once you've tried it a few times, it sort of grows on you, and it's kind of really nice, and it's warming, and it's good. But certainly she talks about it as medicine and eats it for dinner. So it's an interesting kind of combination, I think.
Yeah, Stephen, any observation about food as medicine?
Yeah, exactly. In Chinese perspective, food as medicine provide everywhere. It's a long story, you know.
Yeah, it's a very long history.
Yeah, long history. Just as James said, Chinese cook the food, especially the chicken, with herbs. Yeah, and during the different time period of the year, like in the winter, Chinese store the chicken with rice wine.
Oh yeah, with rice wine, yeah.
Yeah,
and then heat it up, and you eat it all very warm, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because in the Chinese perspective, the human body is a small universe. Mm-hmm. And then Chinese place a qigong on and cook the food with herb to make the body more efficiency and health.
Yeah, it's a kind of a concept of a balance. Of course, the Greeks had a similar idea, right, where you have some foods lead to different kinds of balances or humors. But in Chinese culture, this is really stuck in a way that I think it hasn't in the West. Of course, we only need to go back a couple hundred years and see that in the UK and America, they were still talking about humors and how that be influenced by what you eat. And of course, everybody knows about bleeding, right? You bleed people.
And yes, we even have those knives at home, actually.
Do you really?
We do, yes. I just wanted to ask Stephen.
No, wait a minute. Stop, James. I want to clarify before we go any further. Your father is a doctor.
Yes, that's right. Yes. We don't have sort of dead bodies sort of littered around the garden. He collected them for kind of in relation to his work and sort of, you know, for historic interest. And the historic interest is the main focus here.
Gotcha. Okay, just wanted to make that clear.
So we were just talking about the foods, and I think a really interesting point that comes out from that is that often Chinese people seem to talk about some foods being hot and some being cold, and I'm really surprised by the sort of things that are considered hot and some that are considered cold. And of course, this isn't in the sense of it being a certain temperature, but in the sense of the way it sort of acts on the body. And I thought, Stephen, maybe you could just tell us a little bit about this idea of hot foods and cold foods, because I think it's really a little bit different from maybe what I certainly saw in the West when we talk about this idea.
Yeah. Okay, just as I said, to Chinese, the human body is like a small universe, and they think the temperature inside is higher, right? And then the outside. So the hot food or the warm food is better for the Chinese.
And what sort of things would be considered warm or hot? I had someone the other day, I think when I was eating pineapple, they called this a hot food. Is that right?
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah, it's a complicated question.
Yeah, in fact, I've had the same food. Different people tell me it's. Some people say it's hot and some people say it's cold. It's a little bit confusing.
Right. There's from the nature of the food. It's a kind of a philosophy of Chinese. There's a different yin yang, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hot. This kind of food is hot in nature. And the other kind of food is cold.
It seems to me, I'm not an expert on this. It's really a borderline kind of religious philosophy. So it's,
yes.
There's no way to guess from the food normally. You have to know what the different tables are. I've seen posters where they, you know, lay out different kinds of food. And I've been told by many people, don't eat too many of this kind of fruit because it's too cold. Or don't eat too much of this because it's too hot. You'll get out of balance.
Exactly. Yes. I've had this too. People saying, oh, watch out. That's a hot food. You shouldn't eat too much, like ginger. And at first I was a bit confused, but then slowly I realized people were really talking about something very different from it being physically hot. And, you know, when some foods are so surprising, like pineapple, people talk about it often as being sort of a hot food. And I think the way Stephen's connected it up to the action on the body and yin and yang, it's obviously something that's very complicated. So I just wanted to raise that because I thought it was another interesting angle on how foods are perceived and that whole deep philosophy that sort of connected up with medicine and so on, a whole host of areas
This is great because the thing is, it's this medicine idea and, of course, the hot and cold. Chicken really plays a central role. As you said, James, you've had this chicken mixed up with rice wine before. There's many ways to prepare chicken, and they all link into this idea of somehow balancing your body again, balancing your humors again. So chicken really is a central kind of food in this overall kind of philosophy, food philosophy. So I think there's two points. One is, of course, you have big meals, and we have some photographs about that down here on the webpage. You know, it's very common to get families together. You have a big meal, and of course, you'd have to have a chicken. But on the other hand, you also have it tied up with religious pseudoscience beliefs, and some of those are simple, just eat this because it'll make you feel better, and others are more linked in with a more formalized religion, and here we'll just sum it up as calling it bye-bye, which is a kind of worshiping ceremony, and it's very, very common, and it's always based on the lunar calendar. So, Stephen, what do you think about this religion, or we'll just sum it up as some people would say it's not really a religion, but this bye-bye kind of approach to things. And I was, by the way, I was talking to some friends about this in China, because, you know, you go around China, you don't see it as much as you do in Taiwan. But from what people tell me, it is pretty widespread also.
Mm-hmm. Well, but also very kind of a history. I made shorter. Um, Chinese when Chinese buy, they use three kind of meat, like chicken, pork, and maybe beef or something else to
fish usually I think would be included.
Yeah, fish. In yeah, right. Fish. Fish, pork, and chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There's a normal sets.
Usually beef is avoided because of the tradition of having the ox and on the farm. You don't want to eat your main
machine. They never eat beef for the traditional Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Just as you said. So they use pork, chicken, and fish. These three kind of meats to provide to the god.
Mm-hmm. And this could be to, you know, I think people who maybe come from the West or a Middle East religion might be a little bit confused, because these bye-bye ceremonies are not always just to gods. They could also be to your ancestors who have passed away, the spirits.
Yes, and also the ghosts.
A ghost, yeah. So we have a ghost in Taiwan. We have a ghost month.
Ghost month and a ghost festival.
A ghost festival. And during this time, you have to be very careful to make sure you have enough offerings. But of course, all these offerings, like Stephen said, chicken is very common part of it.
Yes.
And, you know, it's possible you could do a lot of things. In fact, I have photographs of places like McDonald's. They will have their McDonald's McNuggets out there, and they'll stick a stick of incense in there and say, this is bye-bye to the ghosts. It is kind of chicken, I suppose. But I think I think most people, that's going a little bit too far. They really want to have that whole chicken. Stephen, it's kind of odd to see someone cuts up a chicken, has little pieces, and uses that for bye-bye. It's pretty normal to see a whole chicken.
Yes, the whole one. Yeah, you're right.
I think it's kind of a question of respect.
Yes.
Of course, I've gone to many temples, and I've sat down and talked to some of the monks there and asked them, you know, what's the requirement exactly? And, you know, in Taiwan, it's so hard to get that kind of information because nobody really knows.
Yeah, because I think people don't think about it, I think, maybe like that. I don't know. What do you think, Stephen? Because often I have this kind of experience of wanting that kind of, what's the requirement? And then people tell me different things or don't seem to know. It seems a little odd. But
yeah, I think, James, you and me are working on an idea that, you know, there must be a rule book. There must be a Quran or a Bible or a Torah that tells you what to do.
A correct way to do it, yes. But maybe Stephen's got a sort of view on that.
Yeah, it's very complicated for the Chinese religions. Because so many different kind of religions in China, you know. So they are very, very different and various kind of the ceremony and different rules in the different temple or the different places.
And they tend to get all mixed up together.
Yep, right.
Oh, I see. Yes. As Stephen has told us, it's just so complicated, isn't it? It's just so varied, and it's obviously really blurred. But I think it's the thing that I often notice is just walking down the average street, how so many stall holders have the little bye-bye stand outside the shop, and with the ghost money, with some meat, maybe a few other offerings, some drink, and usually the incense is burning. And of course, that's the thing that really catches your nose. You smell the incense and you look across and you see this table set out with these things just in front of a small average store. And it's really, really, really common, really common.
Yeah,
whatever
common,
the store does, whether it's selling motorcycles, whether it's selling travel, whether it's selling food, they often really have this stall outside. It's really interesting. In Hong Kong, I didn't see it quite so much, but usually they have a little kind of vestibules, very small, outside the store where they burn the incense in the same kind of manner.
Yes, you can find that a lot in Taiwan too. You'll go into a store, and it could be a furniture store, it could be any kind of store, and they'll have a little temple stand in a corner up on the wall. So our listeners may be wondering, so what's this all got to do with channels? And the reason is I wanted to drive home the point first, how important these things are. And so now we can look at some of the pictures. And what we have at the first picture are, there's two clear channels of how this chicken is produced in Taiwan. One, of course, is kind of the American UK model, where you have the chickens in a pen and they're raised a certain way, and then they're slaughtered in a factory with a high production rate, and then it ships out to the supermarkets. And in Taiwan, we do have that, but a preferred channel, actually, because of all the things we've talked about, is going to the wet market, where you go there and you can see your whole chicken, you can really pick out the one you want, and it's fresh, key point, fresh. And not only that, people are very comfortable with chickens in general. I've had numerous friends of mine complain they live in high rises, and they are waken up every morning by the chickens cuckoo in the morning, and because somebody's raising chickens in the high rise. And
yes.
And I say, why don't you complain to the, you know, the management, or you guys have a committee, a apartment committee? And he says, oh, it's no use. They just laugh at me when I complain. It's so normal. So this of course has its downside. Many people are worried about the avian flu situation maybe breaking out, because there really are chickens everywhere. But James, you and I were in Singapore recently. We have some pictures from Singapore, 8, 9, 10, 11. And these pictures look so similar to our Taiwan situation, which are pictures 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah, I think that was the thing that really struck me as well, that you had the Singapore that's, I guess, fairly clean. It's sort of legendary for being so clean. And yet, just like in Taiwan, just like in China, you walk down, you've got a sort of tall high rise, maybe a temple sort of stuck on the edge, and then maybe just right in, tucked in between everything there, a market. And once you're inside that market, you could have been anywhere from China to Taiwan to Hong Kong, absolutely anywhere. It was just so familiar. And in fact, I've done a little exercise. I've got photos from Hong Kong, from Singapore, from Taiwan. I mix them up a little bit. Then I've shown them to students in class here and said, oh, where do you think this one is? They say, oh, maybe it's a wet market in Taipei, I think. I say, well, actually, that one's Singapore.
That's
and then
great.
So on. And the recognition, there's absolutely no doubt in these local students' minds that this is a wet market that's probably somewhere in Taiwan.
That's so great. That's a really great exercise. I've never thought about that. I'm going to try to do that too, because if you're a manager and you come over and you just talk to some local managers, especially if they're related to the supermarket channel, they may say something like, well, no, it's totally different there. And here we're, you know, moving in this direction. But, you know, those attitudes are very influenced by who's asking it and their concept of modernity. But meanwhile, the real shoppers who are going out to prepare for dinner are maybe acting very differently.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. I mean, you go into the average wet market and you see someone reaching out and touching the fish or looking at the eye to see how it is, or giving the meat a little bit of a poke to see how fresh it is. And exactly that. So that's just happening in Singapore.
Yeah, even though it's under glass.
Maybe opening
you
the cabinet
opening
and
it.
Getting in to really see how fresh this stuff is. Yeah. And that's such a big part of buying here, really interacting with the produce and really, really wanting to make sure that it's really fresh.
Absolutely. Stephen, in picture 18 and 19, you can see exactly what you were talking about. We have the pork, chicken, and fish all on the table in the ceremony for the bye-bye inside the temple room. This is a family's temple room. And in fact, you can drive on the highway if you're going in towards Taipei or you're leaving Taipei, and you look out and you see all these high-rises and a lot of red lights. And people wonder, you know, is this Christmas or something? And it's just because so many homes have a temple room permanently built into them, and they have to keep that red light on all the time.
Yeah,
I think that's a great, great point in the, because people should appreciate that the temple room is really an important sort of shrine in most local people's houses. And if there's any opportunity to have the space, often it's put in the most attractive preferred spot as sort of respect for the ancestors. And we, in the picture 18 here, we can see that sort of very typical set of images, the red lights, the incense burning, and then the offerings in the front of fruit and the meat and the chicken and the fish, which are just so typical. I've seen that so many times, and the ghost money as well right up front, which is all just so normal. But I think this temple room and this little temple you even go into small apartments and people will have this little temple. It's really integrated into life here.
That's great. That's such a good observation. And I'm afraid, you know, managers would come over here, they might see that, but they don't realize how it influences where you buy at. And in this case, when people do go out to get chicken, which they're getting all the time for family meals and for medical, quote unquote, medical treatments, or what they believe are medical treatments, they're going out and they're looking for that fresh. So the last picture I have here is kind of what I call Warden's Pyramid of Chinese chicken consumption. And what I've done is I think we have a social religious influence that really pushes people to a certain channel. In that case, it's the wet market. And for these reasons, I don't think the wet market is going to be anytime soon disappearing. On the other hand, if you just need to eat something fast, maybe get some chicken pieces at the supermarket. If you go to Carrefour, chicken pieces, they got a lot of selection, a lot of them. Fresh chicken, not so many. Why? Because there's not that many people shopping for a whole fresh chicken there. But for frozen pieces, yeah, sure. I just don't think you'd be using frozen pieces for medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. So you're saying that sort of social importance is often around the religious event. It's around having people over as a sort of big social gathering. It's about when you're really sitting down for an important meal. That's when the social importance you've got on the chicken model is high, is it, Clyde?
Exactly. When you're having that meal, you have to have a pan that has a whole chicken in it. And people will use their chopsticks and pull the pieces off for themselves, and it goes around that Lazy Susan. You could have frozen chicken pieces on there, I suppose, but I don't think
I've never
get a lot
seen
of face.
That. Yeah.
And I've been told many times by people who are not connoisseurs, just regular people, saying they can tell the difference between a chicken that's really fresh or was chilled. And in Chinese eyes, chilling it is almost an equal sin to freezing it.
Yes, yeah, as you say, the chicken parts, I often see parents with kids going and buying these big bags of parts and frying them up. But I've never seen on the Lazy Susan sort of bits of chicken. It's that big piece or the whole chicken right there, and people are ripping bits off of it.
Yeah.
That's really interesting, yes. So that takes you straight up to the top of your pyramid, doesn't it? The instinct is to get fresh and whole for it to fit right in terms of what you want to do.
And I don't think you need to be especially religious person or even aware of it. It's just an automatic assumption. You wouldn't do otherwise, you might lose face. Stephen, what do you think about having those chickens in those big meals and having, it's kind of a face thing, don't you think?
Yeah, sort of.
It'd be embarrassing for someone to accuse you of not having a fresh chicken.
But It up to the family.
Sure.
Sure.
I mean, you know, you're busy and you're just feeding your kids. Obviously, that's not going to be at the top of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, if we think about McDonald's and their parts, where does that kind of put them in this whole model?
Stephen, where do you think McDonald's fits in?
McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken could be at the bottom of this pyramid.
Yeah, I think probably it's at the bottom, high processed, not fresh. Everybody knows that, but it's not a big problem. Although, you know, people will tell you that's not healthy to eat, and I think people tell you that in the West too, probably.
And what's the sort of extension that I'm kind of just wondering about? Actually, is the fact that often older people. Older people, but let's say non-kids often don't really seem to react to McDonald's as food per se.
Yes.
And often I've heard people say, oh, that's for kids. And I do having sort of seen the chicken model before, I've often thought, well, maybe that explains it really, that often because it's parts, people associate it with sort of kids' food and a different type of consumption rather than something that's really a serious meal.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. So I think the ending message is, you know, that we are talking about channels, and yet we spend almost our time talking not about channels but about customs, religions, and beliefs, and cooking habits and medicine. Why? Because that's where the customers are. That's where the consumers are going. And if you want to understand that, you got to get down at that level with those consumers. Stephen, any final comment?
Yeah, I would like to go back to the James' idea of the cold and hot food. I think it's related to the Chinese medicine, the philosophy of the Chinese medicine. They separate the foods into these two kind of categories.
Chinese traditional medicine.
Yes, and it could be another topic we can talk about, but not this. But it is very interesting.
Yes, in fact, that is another topic, Chinese traditional medicine.
Yeah, right. And the food and the Chinese traditional medicine.
Yes, yes. We are going to do a show just on that because that is a huge market. James, any last thoughts?
I think that it's been a really interesting show from my point of view because it's sort of, as you say, we don't seem to have talked about channels, yet we have. Because it's exactly, channels are really defined by people's behaviors and people's preferences. And what we've been really talking about are the things that really drive those preferences. And as we've seen, as Stephen's just mentioned, many of them are very deep and very complex. And I think often quite hard for many people to articulate, to talk about. And so those differences as they then appear in where people shop and what they shop for and how they shop are really important. And I think it's an issue that we're going to keep sort of touching on and exploring as we go through some more shows. So really great, really interesting. And I think the chicken model at the end actually raises so many interesting questions and different ways that people can start to think about food consumption in the Far East, basically.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, good show. See you guys next time.
Likewise. Look forward to it.
This is Talk of Asian Marketing with a special emphasis on localized Chinese consumer behavior. Meow, 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 meow